managers have the option to rein us in with time and area restrictions like they've been doing in the past years, the goal will be met.
The lieutenant governor says no to a ballot initiative that would have banned commercial set netting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, rescuing vessels stuck in Antarctica sea ice.
The Polar Star is heading down there about 8 knots right now, and we expect them to be on scene on January 12th.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell rejected a proposed ballot initiative aimed at banning commercial set netting throughout most of the state today. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the language in the initiative didn't agree with a previous Alaska court ruling.
The proposed initiative would have been on the 2016 ballot, and voters would have decided whether or not to ban commercial set netting in urban areas of the state, including Cook Inlet, where commercial set netting makes up a big chunk of the economy. It was proposed by the Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance. That group's main concern is keeping dwindling king salmon stocks out of those set nets. The group's spokesperson, Joe Connors, was not available for comment on Monday, but when the group announced its effort back in November, Connors said the regular process for changing management practices and conserving king salmon isn't working.
The Board of Fish and Game gets diluted by the need to continue the set net fishery because it's a way of life, you know, whatever, whatever. But the bottom line is everything indicates, all the indicators, We have historically low numbers, and we cannot continue to have this wall of death functioning.
Sport fishers on the river and set netters out in the inlet have had their fishing time severely restricted the past 2 years in an effort to preserve those king salmon, which are coming back later in the season and in smaller numbers. In its memo to the lieutenant governor, the State Department of Law cited a 1996 court decision that said appropriating fish to different user groups could not be done by ballot initiative. There were two objectives with that case. One was to prevent an electoral majority from giving itself access to a state resource, and the other was to preserve the legislature's power to make decisions about allocation. The proposed initiative violated both of those objectives, and according to the Attorney General, quote, removed the Board of Fisheries' discretion to make allocation decisions in times of shortages. This is certainly a time of shortage for king salmon. In 2013, just over 17,000 kings returned to the Kenai River, barely making the sustainable escapement goal of 15,000. Opposition to the ballot proposal was immediate, with various commercial fishing groups speaking against it, and both the Kenai City Council and the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly adopting resolutions against it. Calls for comment from the commercial-friendly Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association were also not returned in time for this story, but its president, Rob Williams, testified at that assembly meeting in December. He called the move ballot box biology.
For 27 years, we've made the goal for the late-run fish in the Kenai River. 27 years straight. 15 of those years, we exceeded the upper end of the goal. And right now, our managers have the option to rein us in with time and area restrictions like they've been doing in the past years. The goal will be met.
In a news release Monday, the executive director of the group that proposed the ban, Clark Penny, called the decision by the lieutenant governor puzzling. That group is now evaluating a possible legal challenge. Other changes in the management of King Salmon and Cook Inlet could be made next month. The Board of Fish will take up those issues and hundreds of proposals to deal with the problem when it meets in Anchorage. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
A newly refurbished Coast Guard icebreaker is en route to Antarctica to free two vessels stuck in ice. The stuck ships are a Russian research vessel and a Chinese icebreaker, says Allison Conroy, the Coast Guard's chief warrant officer for the Pacific area. The Russian ship has been stranded since before Christmas. The Chinese vessel got stuck when it tried to help. Conroy says the Coast Guard cutter Polar Star is being sent to the scene. The heavy-duty icebreaker just just finished undergoing a three-year, $90 million overhaul. The Polar Star set out from Sydney on Saturday. Conroy says the Chinese ship's helicopter has evacuated the passengers from the Russian ship, but the vessel's crews are still on board.
The Polar Star is heading down there about 8 knots right now, and we expect them to be on scene on January 12th. Once on scene, they plan to break the ice out around the two ships once they break a navigational path through the sea ice. And that way, the two ships that are beset will then be able to leave the area under their own power.
Conroy says Coast Guard ships are often tasked with breaking ice to keep navigational lanes clear. The Coast Guard cutter Healy performed one such mission in Alaska in 2010 when it helped a Russian vessel break a channel through sea ice to resupply Nome with fuel. But Conroy says it's more rare for an icebreaker to have to rescue other ships like the Polar Star is setting out to do.
The search and rescue mission that it's embarking on now is actually kind of unique. The last time we probably heard about ships being beset in ice, you can read in your history books.
This is the first time the Polar Star has been to Antarctica since 2006. After this, it'll embark on its main mission, breaking ice to help resupply the U.S. Antarctic Program's field stations. Otna Traditional First Chief Ben Neely passed away Saturday at his home in Gulkana. He was 99. Ben Neely was born in 1914 to Tom Neely and Fanny Ewen. At a time when the Otna people still practiced a primarily nomadic lifestyle, traveling throughout the Otna region following traditional food sources. As a child, Neely did not attend school. Instead, he learned the traditional Otna way of life from people like his father. It wasn't until much later in life that Ben was adopted as his English name. In 1950, Neely married Hazel Ewen, with whom he had 8 children. He worked on the Glen Highway, the Toke Cutoff, and the road from Fort Richardson to Valdez. He was a heavy equipment operator for the Alaska Department of Transportation before retiring in 1977. In 2006, Otna elders selected him as the new Otna Traditional Chief after the death of Chief Harry John Sr. As chief, he represented the Otna way of life. His words are remembered for their honesty and wisdom. A humble and generous man, Neely had a simple yet powerful message for his people: love one another, try your best to get along, and work together. Neely is survived by 16 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka teacher is recognized for her work.
I try to use local resources as much as I can to connect kids to science.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
A December 23rd traffic accident claimed the life of Rick Leo of Trapper Creek. Leo was well known as a writer and advocate for environmental stewardship in the Upper Matsu Valley. KTNA's Philip Manning has the story.
Rick Leo lived in the Upper Susitna Valley for more than 3 decades. Rick was born in Chicago and went to college at Harvard and lived in New York City before moving his family to Alaska in 1981. After arriving, he authored 2 books, wrote a column for the Anchorage Daily News for 6 years, and was an outspoken activist for environmental causes. Most recently, he was a major player in organizing the Susitna River Coalition, a group opposing the Susitna-Watonna hydroelectric project. Fellow longtime Trapper Creek resident Rick Ernst says that Rick Leo was a voice for many who place high importance on the environment.
I've always admired him being fairly articulate and able to put down on paper these feelings that a lot of us have about our environment and what's happening in the state here.
Rick Leo's homestead is referred to as the Ridgeline. His 2 books and many of his columns detailed life in and near Trapper Creek and the impact that living in the wilderness of Alaska had on him. Whitney Wolf, fellow member of the Susitna River Coalition and chair of the Talkeetna Community Council, says that Rick's activism was not a show.
A lot of his activism, I would say, was, you know, a result of a life truly lived for wildland. And, you know, he was a purist. He mushed in and out of the ridgeline, never had a snow machine, did his firewood and all his house logging with his team, and really lived the life that he wrote about.
Words used to describe Rick Leo often center around the concepts of intelligence and passion. His willingness to stand up and be heard on a variety of local and environmental issues will be missed, says Rick Ernst.
You know, I'm going to miss him. I think we're going to miss a good spokesman for those values.
Rick Leo was 61 at the time of his passing and is survived by two sons.
In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Last week, Alaska Senator Mark Begich wrote a letter to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell asking her to exercise restraint in upcoming policy recommendations on the ivory trade. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Begich says that while illegal global trafficking of elephant ivory is a serious problem, new rules need to take the walrus ivory used by Alaskan hunters and carvers into consideration.
My biggest worry is that they will come up with some broad sweeping catch-all, everything ban on ivory, which would be a huge mistake in the long term for what Alaskans utilize ivory for. And so I'm nervous that their discussions may lead to an economic impact.
Senator Begich's letter to Secretary Jewell came partly from concerns that decisions made far away in D.C. were not duly considering the Alaskans they'd affect.
We just don't want to get caught up into another Washington, D.C., you know, behind closed doors kind of thinking of how the world should be. And so what I've tried to do in this letter is kind of put a warning up that as they review this issue, that there are legitimate small businesses that acquire ivory legally and use it in a manner that is important for Alaska's economy and other parts of the national economy.
Last summer, President Obama signed an executive order assembling a task force to recommend new strategies for eliminating illegal ivory markets. That task force met for the first time in December. Jessica Kershaw is the spokeswoman for the U.S. Department of the Interior. She said in an email that the policy measures the Advisory Council will present to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are intended to effectively end the commercial ivory trade within the United States. Though no laws have yet been adopted or modified, the broad goal, Kershaw's email stated, is to reduce demand for ivory in the U.S. and worldwide. The policy recommendations coming from the Department of the Interior explicitly target elephant ivory, rhinoceros horns, and byproducts of endangered animals coming into the country from poaching abroad. Since walruses are not endangered and are harvested domestically, the law does nothing to their legal status. Everything about walrus ivory would technically stay the same. But what worries Begich is the tone of the current policy overhaul. Begich says that discouraging an appetite for illegal elephant ivory is one thing, but he's nervous that ivory harvested legally from the Bering Sea region will be a casualty of growing condemnation.
Again, I'm worried about how the discussion is occurring and that they should be very clear that Alaska ivory is exempt from this in the sense of walrus ivory. Just the fact the way they're discussing it, I've had people come to me and already concerned because it's not clear in the presentations they're making and not being very descriptive. It does have an economic impact on the purchasing of Alaska ivory when it shouldn't.
Back in November, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department co-sponsored an event with the World Wildlife Fund and International Fund for Animal Welfare. 25 years worth of illegally recovered ivory, nearly 6 tons of it in all, was pulverized in a giant rock crusher. It was a symbolic gesture to try spreading the message that ivory should no longer be revered as a luxury object in its own right. Exactly the kind of message Begich is worried will hurt the Alaskan hunters and carvers who depend on income from a viable market for walrus ivory products. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A Sitka educator has won a presidential award for excellence in mathematics and science. Rebecca Himshute teaches science. She's one of two Alaskan teachers honored by the White House this year and one of only 102 teachers nationwide who received the recognition, which includes a $10,000 cash prize from the National Science Foundation. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Rebecca Hemshoot is the science teacher for 2nd through 5th grades. She says that she really doesn't do anything extraordinary for her students beyond what any good teacher tries to do. It's mainly about keeping kids engaged. The skies over Sitka are gray and rainy much of the time. Learning about planets and astronomy can be a tough sell. But Hemshoot, through a grant from the local charitable trust, brings in a star lab every year and inflates it, sort of like a giant bouncy castle, inside the gym.
If my teacher in elementary school had brought a planetarium into the classroom, it probably would have caught my attention and maybe even changed the direction I went with my education.
Hemshoot also takes advantage of opportunities for professional development that other teachers may not. In 2007, she traveled aboard a research vessel for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as one of NOAA's Teachers at Sea. It was a 3-week cruise in the Bering Sea studying the pollock fishery. But she also finds opportunities closer to home.
I try to use local resources as much as I can to connect kids to science. So I bring in lots of Forest Service scientists. So I think it's those little extras that might catch attention.
It was Forest Service biologist Rob Miller who nominated Hemshoot for the award, which goes to only 2 teachers from each state. The national recognition, along with a lot of rest over vacation, has helped energize her for getting back into the classroom.
I feel an obligation if I have the great gift of being allowed to teach science all day, every day, then that comes also with the responsibility of helping kids connect more to science and making it more real for them.
Besides winning $10,000, which she can spend any way she likes, Hemshoot will get an all-expense-paid trip to Washington, D.C. and a chance to meet President Obama. Hemshoot's colleague from Alaska sharing this year's honor is Amy Laufer, a former math teacher at Kassoon Elementary in Anchorage, who now works for the school district office. I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Electronic health records free Alaskans from the paper chase by giving doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where they need it. Electronic health records increase safety and security. Electronic records take health information out of the filing cabinet and into the digital light. You can find out more at ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
If you get sick, really sick, there's a good chance you'll end up on a flight out of town. Medical evacuations called medevacs are taking more and more Alaskans to in-state and lower 48 critical care facilities. But the medevac system is undergoing changes with new aircraft, more competition, and a shift in patients' needs. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
KJ Harris is a Ketchikan bartender who's been in the business a long time. That almost came to an end about 8 years ago when he felt a strong pain in his chest.
I had a heart attack. Once they gave me this massive shot, the blood buster, clot buster, whatever they said, I had to go south, and I said, sure.
Harris is one of several thousand Alaskans medevaced each year because they need care not available near home. Southeast residents mostly use air ambulances from Airlift Northwest and Guardian Flight. Others, such as LifeMed Alaska, also serve the region. Shelley Deering is a flight nurse who's also Alaska Regional Manager for Airlift Northwest.
We do primarily cardiac patients out of Southeast Alaska. And then we do a fair amount of patients who are ill with an infection that gets beyond just the typical infection that can be handled with antibiotics.
You know, you have the flu season, the respiratory season, that always facilitates a number of transport needs. And then also occasionally neuro patients are transported.
Shannon Pollack is Vice President of Business for Salt Lake City-based Air Medical Resource Group. That's the parent company of Guardian Flight and 5 other air ambulance companies. He says a medevac starts when a patient arrives at a hospital or clinic in serious condition or just needs a higher level of care.
A physician or a primary care provider must make the determination that a patient needs to be transported from point A to point B.
Point B has to agree to take them. then a medevac plane's called in, unless one's already on the ground.
So we have single stretcher here.
Shelley Deering shows me the interior of an Airlift Northwest Learjet parked at the Juneau Airport.
We can monitor 12 leads for our cardiac patients. We can defibrillate them if we need to. We have a transport ventilator, so if somebody has a breathing tube in, that we can breathe for them on the way down to Seattle.
The region's first air ambulance service was Airlift Northwest, which is part of the University of Washington Medical System. It's flown out of Seattle for more than 30 years, and it's based in aircraft in Juneau for more than half of that time. Last spring, it added a propeller-driven turbo commander, which can land at smaller airports. It picked up some competition about 10 years ago when Fairbanks-based Guardian Flight put aircraft in Sitka and Ketchikan. Pollock says it's become Alaska's largest medevac provider.
Like most of us that begin this service, it was in response to a need and not enough medical transport resources in place for the need.
Guardian uses Learjets plus more maneuverable King Air turboprops. Pollock says it has 11 planes at 7 bases from Ketchikan to Kotzebue.
We have more aircraft and more resources in the state of Alaska than Airlift Northwest does. Beyond that, I'm not exactly sure what the differences are.
Here's a couple. Airlift Northwest staffs its jets and planes with 2 highly trained flight nurses. Guardian uses 1, plus a flight paramedic. And Airlift medevacs women with problem pregnancies. Guardian does not. Competition isn't the only challenge facing air ambulance operations. They're also carrying more patients in very bad shape.
Because treatments and medications are better than they used to be.
Jennifer Briner is chief nursing officer at the Petersburg Medical Center.
In order for us to transfer somebody with a medical illness, they have to be very sick. So I think for sure they're sicker today when they're transported than they were 10, 15 years ago.
Shelley Deering of Airlift Northwest.
I think one of the big changes we've seen over the years is the cardiac care. Patients who used to have a cardiac arrest didn't survive. And now we see more and more of those patients coming back into the communities. And most of the time, they come back to their previous state of health.
And with more services, with more aircraft, patients are getting where they need to go quicker. Guardian Flight's Shannon Pollock.
Unlike, 20, 30 years ago, I think patients are waiting a lot less than they were then for air medical transportation, even if all resources are flying at the time they need them.
The competition and medical changes are important, but for patients such as Ketchikan bartender K.J. Harris, it's all about the service.
I mean, you saved my life. I was pretty happy with that.
He still lives in Ketchikan, working the bars and serving on the city council. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The Department of Justice last week filed criminal charges against a Haynes heli-skiing company for repeatedly operating tours on federal land without a permit. The violations came to light because of a fatal accident within the off-limits area in March of last year. Margaret Friednauer of KHNS has more.
In documents filed in U.S. District Court, attorneys claim Southeast Alaska Backcountry Adventures, or SEBA, operated heli-ski tours in an area near Haynes regulated by the Bureau of Land Management. The federal agency requires commercial tour companies apply for and receive permits from the agency to operate on the land. SEBA had the appropriate permits from 2002 to 2006. Then, before the 2007 season began, BLM closed the area to tours and didn't grant permits in order to conduct studies. SEBA applied for a permit for the same area in 2011, but was told the area was still closed. But the company admits in court documents that it still conducted tours in that area. It includes an area just southwest of Haynes with a 60-degree mountain slope that's considered an expert ski run. Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrea Stewart says the permit violations came to light because of an accident in March that claimed the life of a SEBA employee and injured 2 clients.
You know, it came to our attention only because of the fatality. And then looking into it, it turned out it was an ongoing pattern and practice of the organization.
The Haynes Borough regulates the heli-skiing industry in areas within the borough. Heli-skiing companies are required to provide GPS coordinates to the borough after any accident or fatality. After submitting the coordinates of the March 3rd accident, it became apparent the company was operating technically within the borough-designated heli-ski boundaries, but on BLM land closed to use. The agency began an investigation and turned the issue over to the Department of Justice because operating on the land without a permit is considered trespassing, Stewart says.
There's a statute that makes it criminally illegal. There are also potential administrative penalties as well.
In the plea deal, SEBA acknowledges operating 54 tours since 2011 in that same area without a permit. The company agrees to pay a $10,000 fine plus $11,500 in restitution, the amount the company would have paid in permit fees for the land use. The company will also be on probation for 2 years and agrees to provide BLM with GPS data to ensure compliance with tour area boundaries. One of SEBA's owners, Nick Trimble, was reached at his home in Haines on Wednesday, but did not want to comment on the case because the plea agreement has yet to be approved by a judge. That is expected to take place by the end of the month. The Haines Borough has already penalized the company for the March 3rd incident. Earlier this year, it fined SEBA $500 for violating conditions of its borough permit by not having all the other necessary state and federal permits to conduct its business. The borough also reduced the number of skier days the company could use when it was issued its 2014 permit. Heli-skiing is a controversial issue in Haines. While it accounts for a large portion of winter tourism, the way the industry is regulated by the borough creates friction between industry supporters and some residents concerned by noise and impacts on wildlife. Some residents say this latest development highlights issues with the industry. Eric Hawley is the president of Lynn Canal Conservation. The group advocates for consistent regulation of the heli-ski industry in Haines by the borough.
What we would hope to see come from this is that the borough itself would take a deeper look at what's been going on here, look at the GPS tracks for recent years, and see in what areas outside of the BLM areas that SEBA's been operating in violation.
Interim borough manager Julie Causey said in an email she is discussing the issue with BLM and will report to the assembly at its next meeting. Borough code allows the manager to suspend or revoke a commercial tour permit for noncompliance or violations. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friednauer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shailen Cochran in Kenai, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Margaret Friednauer in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.